Welcome to the Legal Aid New South Wales Criminal Law Division podcast. The Criminal Law Division of Legal Aid New South Wales acknowledges the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as the traditional custodians of the land and waters. We acknowledge this podcast is recorded on Aboriginal land and pay our respect to elders past and present. We extend that respect to First Nations listeners joining us here today.
Welcome everyone. Today we are recording this podcast on Bundjalung and Arakwal country. I'm Sophie Anderson from Commercial Bank Chambers in Lismore and the date is the 2nd of March 2024. I'm here with one of my other pod counterparts, Caitlin Akhtar, who is joining us from Sydney. Caitlin, what are the cases on this episode of Five Cases podcast about?
Hi Sophie, I'm excited to be up here on beautiful Bundjalung country and excited to have learned a little bit about the Arakwal people while I've been up here. I'm going to look at how a bail application might be both successful and unsuccessful in Hickey and the Director of Public Prosecutions, New South Wales, 2024 New South Wales SC 191. And I'm also going to tackle the thorny technical issue of imposing ICOs for Commonwealth offences, which was recently confirmed in AM and R 2024 New South Wales CCA 26. How about you, Sophie? What have you got for us today?
So I've got a recent drug driving case from the Court of Criminal Appeal in a decision of R and Nauruz, 2024 New South Wales CCA 14. A recent decision on license suspension in Wells and R, 2024 New South Wales CCA. And moving away from driving offences, but to a very important decision, the one on the use of the Bugney Bar Book in the decision of Baines and R 2023 New South Wales CCA 302.
Well, I know that one of Baines is the one that I'm particularly looking forward to, so let's dive in.
Okay, so I might start us off with Nauruz then. That was a decision that was handed down on the 19th of February 2024, with the leading decision by Harrison, Chief Judge at Common Law from paragraph 2. It's a decision of obviously the Court of Criminal Appeal, but it started in the local court and went on appeal to the district court. It then came to the CCA as a stated case from the district court, which is an important fact. Basically, the facts are that the applicant was pulled over by police and subjected to an oral fluid test, which provided a positive result for cocaine. He gave evidence in the local court that he did not contest a number of the elements of the offence, including driving, nor the oral fluid test finding, but how the cocaine may have entered his system and been present for the purpose of the offence. He sought to rely on a defence being honest and reasonable mistake of fact, and in fact advanced a position that he had been sipping from a bottle of energy drink left on the floor by his friend when he was in his friend's car, and that he had done that 45 minutes before the test, and that then could have been a possible explanation for the result. The magistrate at first instance accepted that it was open for the applicant to argue honest and reasonable mistake of fact, but that he didn't accept the applicant's evidence, and he ultimately was found guilty and that the prosecution had proved the offence beyond a reasonable doubt. On appeal to the district court, District Court Judge Buscombe found that the offence was a strict liability offence and therefore determined that the defence raised by the applicant couldn't have been raised as a defence anyway. And he then dismissed the appeal. But what he did do is he put the matter up to the CCA on a stated case pursuant to Section 5B of the Criminal Appeal Act 1912, the first of which was found in the positive. So the CCA found that it didn't need to address the second question. That first question was, is Section 111(1) of the Road Transport Act 2013 an offence of strict liability? So in determining that question, the CCA held that mens rea forms no part of the offence of absolute liability where guilt is established by proof of the elements of the offence, and the ground of exculpation being where the person is acting on an honest and reasonable mistake of fact cannot apply to an offence of that kind. That's at paragraph 28 of the judgment. But the court did look at situations where a person might unwittingly or unknowingly contravene the provisions of section 111, subsection 1, and that even in those cases, which were described by the court as hardship cases, that those rare times should not override the public safety objectives of the legislation. And that was determined that if there is an injustice that is occasioned because of those kind of situations, that they can be avoided by sound exercise of prosecutorial or sentencing discretions. And that is described from paragraph 82 to 83.
What do you say we should take from it? I mean, it sounds like there's not much left for us in terms of a defence.
Given the previous decision of New South Wales Police and Correll from 2016, which that was a decision by His Honour Magistrate Halpern sitting at Lismore Local Court at the time, that was a decision which really did take the leading position on this issue. What this new decision confirms is that the defence of honest and reasonable mistake of fact does not apply to strict liability cases. I would suggest that that has broader application than just in terms of this particular offence. Secondly, that whilst it's a matter of statutory interpretation, that the reading of the legislation will override any other considerations.
I understand that your next case is also on traffic law.
It is. I thought I would bunch them together. So the next one is on license suspension. So in this decision of Wells and the King 2024 New South Wales CCA at 8, the facts are that the applicant effectively was sentenced to a very lengthy sentence following an aggravated dangerous driving occasioning death offence. The applicant received a total term of 5 years and 6 months with a non-parole period of 3 years. The reason why that is important is in terms of then the disqualification period that then was imposed as an automatic. The sentencing judge imposed at first instance a 3 year license disqualification period, which was in accordance with the requirements in section 205 of the Road Transport Act. And in doing so, requested the RMS to consider the license suspension in determining the final period of disqualification. The applicant's license was suspended on the date that the offences occurred for which the applicant had been sentenced. Now, pursuant to section 206B, subsection 2 of the Road Transport Act, that provides that a court is required to take into account the period of license suspension when ultimately coming to the question of the disqualification. And in this particular appeal, the applicant had appealed the sentence. The court decided, and it was a three-judge bench, allowed the ground on the basis that it would have reduced the total disqualification period. The court found that the judge erred by failing to take into account the time of the applicant's license suspension, and that by asking the RMS to take that into account rather than doing so themselves, that the judge fell into error. Effectively, what it found is that section 206B doesn't give a court the power to order the RMS to take into account the suspension period. The judge is required to take into account the period and set the period accordingly. So that's that decision.
I guess that's going to be important to read and place close attention to when we're representing people in the local court and these technical issues about what the start date of the disqualification period is going to be at least as important as the length of the disqualification period. So
yeah,
it's going to be an important case to consider. I thought I'd just try and jump around a bit with issues today. So I've got one on bail and one on ICOs. I might start with Hickey and the Director of Public Prosecutions. It's a Supreme Court bail decision. And of course, I'm well aware, as you are, and I'm sure the listeners are, about the caution that's been kind of urged upon people when they're taking into account first instance single judge decisions on bail. But I think it's important because what Justice Hamill has done in this bail is granted this particular defendant, Mr. Hickey, he's granted him bail on one set of proceedings and refused bail on another set of proceedings in circumstances where bail was applied for on both sets of proceedings. So what Justice Hamill found is that in respect of the first set of proceedings in which the person had pleaded guilty and was due for sentence in a matter of a short number of weeks, that cause had not been shown why detention in respect of those offences was not justified, even though it looked like what's probably going to happen in respect of those offences is that Mr. Hickey's representatives are going to ask the sentencing judge to impose or consider imposing an intensive corrections order. Justice Hamill was cautious about granting bail in circumstances where that might be seen to be a fetter or an attempt at a fetter on the sentencing judge's discretion. And I guess you and I and many people listening would be familiar with that kind of concern that's raised by magistrates or judges who are considering granting bail, that the sentence is coming up and they don't wish to be seen as looking like they're trying to predict or influence the outcome of the sentence. But this person, Mr. Hickey, also had a second set of proceedings for which he pleaded not guilty and which was expected to take a much longer time to resolve. And in respect of those offences, Justice Hamill was satisfied. The person had shown cause why his detention was not justified and presented a set of conditions that adequately mitigated the risks that were presented on bail. And so what Justice Hamill resolved to do was to refuse bail on the first set of proceedings, so that the effect of the order was that Mr. Hickey was to remain in custody for, I think it was 3 weeks until he was to be sentenced on the first set of proceedings. But he had granted bail on the second set of proceedings such that if he were sentenced to an intensive correction order on that first set of proceedings, he would then be released. He'd be able to enter into his intensive correction order and he'd be able to proceed on conditional liberty, that is bail, until the second set of proceedings were finalised. Now, this is not a CCA decision. It's not a decision that I say everybody needs to kind of keep a printed copy of in their back pocket, but it's important because all of us, I think, when we're going about our day-to-day practice, can come across decisions where we think, look, the pragmatic response here is maybe we don't get on bail on this set of proceedings, but we should get it on this second set of proceedings. This is just a decision that says there's no problem with doing that in terms of the Bail Act. There's nothing stopping a magistrate or a judge or a Supreme Court justice from saying, look, I'm going to maintain the refusal of bail on one set of proceedings, but I'm going to grant bail on the second set of proceedings, and here are my reasons why. So that's why I think that this decision of Hickey and the Director of Public Prosecutions is worth practitioners looking at if they've got a bit of a complicated or a tricky bail.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Now, the second case today is initials AM and R, 2024, New South Wales CCA 26. And I'll admit that this decision is effectively the second decision on cases that look at the imposition of an intensive correction order for Commonwealth offences. Now, it's a little bit of a vexed issue. The current state of the law in New South Wales is that intensive correction orders can be imposed for Commonwealth offences, and that's going to be the position until the High Court or someone else says differently. But it's a little bit complicated because Commonwealth law requires a court to consider Commonwealth sentencing legislation. And then if they decide to impose an aggregate sentence or an intensive correction order, which are state-based sentences, the sentencing judge then needs to move to New South Wales legislation, i.e. the Crime Sentencing Procedure Act. And what needs to happen is if a judge is considering imposing an intensive correction order, or if you or I or somebody else is asking a judge to consider imposing an intensive correction order for somebody who is being sentenced for a Commonwealth offence, what they need to do is first consider the Commonwealth sentencing legislation in terms of what an appropriate sentence is, and then they need to move to the New South Wales Crime Sentencing Procedure Act, and they need to move to Section 66(3) of the Sentencing Act and decide whether an intensive corrections order is an appropriate penalty. Now, that's quite complicated in and of itself. And in this case, that is AM and R, the judge did take that step. But what she didn't do is take this further third step, which is in deciding whether to impose an intensive corrections order. They need to decide, firstly, whether full-time custody or an ICO is going to better promote community safety, which you and I know, Sophie, is according to Section 66 of the Crime Sentencing Procedure Act, that's the paramount consideration. Paramount consideration. Thank you very much. But what the sentencing judge then also needs to do is to consider not the Commonwealth Sentencing Act, which they've been doing up until this point, because that's what they're required to do, but they need to then turn their minds to Section 3 capital A of the Crime Sentencing Procedure Act, which is the state legislation, which I have to say is quite a complicated exercise. They've got to consider a lot of factors. And the court in AM and R emphasized that these factors, although there is a lot of overlaps, do contain differences of focus. And that Section 3 capital A is focused on the purposes of sentencing, and that all these things need to be considered when they're deciding whether to impose an intensive corrections order or not. Now, ultimately, in AM and R, the Court of Criminal Appeal were satisfied that the sentencing judge didn't do that final step. So she considered very, very comprehensively the Commonwealth sentencing legislation. She then considered whether she was satisfied that full-time custody or an intensive corrections order was going to better facilitate community safety. And she basically considered that she couldn't make a finding either way on the evidence that she had, but she didn't undertake that third step, which was then to consider the three capital A purposes of sentencing. And they decided that in resentencing, which is the exercise that the Court of Criminal Appeal undertakes when they think there's been an error, that they would have imposed a lesser sentence. Now, in fairness to the sentencing judge of the district court, she was operating in an environment where the leading case on this issue, which is Chan and R, 2023 New South Wales CCA 206, that decision actually hadn't been published yet. So it's completely understandable that she would not have known that she needed to undertake this very complicated sentencing exercise. Pretty kind of full-on technical judgment, Sophie, but one that's going to be important for anyone that's trying to get a sentence for a person being sentenced for a Commonwealth offence.
The economy of time has no factor to play in that consideration.
None.
Very interesting. Lastly, the decision of Baines and Rex, which is 2023 New South Wales CCA 302. Focus that I want to take on it for the purpose of today is the use of the Bug Me Bar book, which hopefully people are being able to utilise in productive ways in their practice. Looking at the facts of this case, though, the applicant was effectively found guilty of murder and was sentenced at first instance to a very lengthy term of 36 years imprisonment with a non-parole period of 27 years. At sentence, the applicant relied on expert evidence, which was by way of a psychological report, and also called evidence from the applicant's family, and also tended and relied upon various chapters of the Bug Me Bar book, which were all admitted into evidence without objection from the Crown. The applicant then appealed the sentence on the basis that the judge had fallen into error. Effectively, though, the appeal was allowed and the applicant was resentenced with a significant reduction in that initial sentence. But for the purpose of this, it's a clear case in which the Bug Me principles ought to have been applied at first instance. It's not possible to draw any general conclusions about the content of the Bug Me Bar book, but the court found very importantly that it can lay the foundation for an acceptance of the relevance of the evidence given in the offender's case, and in particular when regard is had to personal circumstances, for example. It may be that the Bug Me Bar book added little in this particular case, But that conclusion will largely be dependent on the facts. That is the distinction in this case, that where it was found that the relevance of the Bug Me Bar book had little work to do, that it was really based on the evidence that was put forward to the court with respect to this particular applicant. And the court ultimately found at 97 that there was ample evidence to establish that the applicant had come from a deprived background. So that was a very, very important consideration of the use of the bar book. So in summary, what the decision says is that, again, it really depends on the nature of the case and how the Bug Me Bar book material is sought to be used in those proceedings, as was determined here, because it was tendered in addition to actual expert evidence, that it was still important to consider what work there was for it to do in the sentencing proceedings. The appeal was not directed to the admissibility of the evidence, but rather the treatment of the evidence. And that's a really important distinction in terms of consideration, what practitioners should take away from it. It's really important, and this has been consistently said, that the Bug Me Bar book material is not a substitute for evidence about the actual individual offender. That should come as very little surprise to people. Of course, the evidence that is relevant to that offender is the best evidence, and that is the evidence that should be tendered. Evidence from the Bug Me Bar book really complements that evidence about the individual and may contextualise it or place it within an understanding that the court can then consider how that behaviour might exist in a broader context. It's not there to draw general conclusions, and in fact this case itself says that it's not actually possible to draw any of those general conclusions about the actual material, but it is there to assist the decision maker. The judgment, particularly by His Honour Danji, is relevant there, so take a look at it.
Fantastic. Well, I think that's all the time we have for today, but I just want to say again that we're very grateful to Matthew Dimmick and Legal Aid for giving us a platform for the podcast, and thank you all for listening, and we are excited to have some more things for you to listen to in this new year.
The Five Cases podcast, of course, is on the Legal Aid Criminal Law Division channel on all podcast services. We can be contacted on our email at fivecasespodcast@gmail.com. We'd love your feedback and any suggestions on cases or topics that you'd like us to cover. And we look forward to talking with you next time.
See you next time.
See you later.